to the Berkman Audio Fishbowl from the Berkman Center for Internet and Society at Harvard University. Each week, we feature conversations with leading cyber scholars, entrepreneurs, activists, and policymakers as they explore the bleeding edge of the internet and technology, democracy, law, and society. For more information on the Berkman Center and for more programs like this, visit cyber.law.harvard.edu.
Out of curiosity, how many people here receive Avaaz.org emails at the moment? Awesome. And how many people receive MoveOn.org or GetUp in Australia emails? Okay. Well, first let me tell you what Winston Churchill said about public speaking. What Winston Churchill said about public speaking is that you should say what you're going to say, say it, and then say what you just said. And that's what Winston Churchill said about public speaking. So what I will say, I want to talk briefly about the supposed difference or the two supposed models of online activism, net-centric activism and broadcast model activism. Then about Avaaz, what it is, what our model is, and a little bit, one sort of case study of what we've done, which is to talk about Burma. And then put a question to you guys, which is how to do more, and particularly what insights or models from other models of activism could be used to leverage Avaaz. We have something really exciting going right now at a global scale, and we're discovering that there's just an enormous appetite for people around the world to kind of aggregate quickly around issues of public concern, and finding ways that we can increase the amount of campaigning work that we're able to do without sacrificing the core kind of democratic and quality and mission aspects of the model. That's the big challenge. We have a couple of ideas, but I'd very much be interested in yours and in your feedback. So first of all, these models of activism. There's the a MIT meteorologist decades ago said that if a butterfly flaps its wings in Brazil, it can cause, well, there's many different forms of the adage, but you could cause a thunderstorm in Belgium. And his point was actually about the complexity of systems, but this has become a metaphor for the way that small things can make a big difference in the world. And it's sometimes used with relation to the internet and the way that everybody can have a voice and affect decisions and processes everywhere. The trouble is there's actually many, many butterflies. And if you're a single butterfly in Brazil and there's a drought in Belgium, the question of how you can help bring rain to that drought-stricken country is a question without an obvious answer. And so part of what, essentially what I think the internet offers is the possibility that you can create ways to allow people to think globally and act globally and for actions everywhere to affect decisions anywhere. And Avaaz brings one approach to this. The idea of net-centric activism is kind of emergent from networks, people generating wherever they are, generating things and picking up other things and movements kind of emerging from an organic bottom-up process. And this is the grass mud sheep, there's various translations of it, but this is an image in China, character for which is actually an obscene phrase that the government has banned, but people have used this image all over the Chinese internet as a protest against government censorship. And it's an example of the way that net-centric activism, another example right now is Twitter in Iran. Many people doing many things, and governments can't have a very difficult time clamping down on it because there's no central hub. The challenge with net-centric activism, there are two. One is the challenge of channeling sort of latent public interest or an intense desire to act into actions that, when aggregated, can have a strategic effect. And so with the grass mud sheep, it demonstrates to the government the limits of censorship, and it provides an expressive outlet, but it doesn't fundamentally change the power calculus that the government faces, in a sense. With Iran, it's a journalistic medium. But you know, right now the government is shutting down internet access wherever it can, and it's difficult without kind of channels that are established to essentially confront power in that kind of in that kind of way. I guess it's sort of like a shotgun blast versus a laser beam, that you can get a lot of you can move a lot of stuff, but if you want to hit a precise target, it's very difficult with it, and to do it quickly, especially difficult with a net-centric model. So Avaaz broadly is in the broadcast category of online activism, but as we talk, I think some of this sort of dichotomy will collapse. Broadcast in the sense that at the core of Avaaz is a huge email list. It's a broad global membership, and there's a small staff that serves that membership by sending emails in 14 languages, although not always in all 14. And broadcast model is also with MoveOn, also the Obama campaign, essentially is the sort of network structure is a scale-free network where there's a hub and spokes. And so campaigns are generated by a core team and sent out to people for them to participate in. The key for this to work, however, is for it not to really just be a broadcast, but more of a dialogue. And that's the core thing at Avaaz. The mission of Avaaz is to try to close the gap between the world we have and the world that most people everywhere want. And so the founding idea is that on a broad range of the biggest issues the world faces, from climate change to human rights to conflict, there's actually a broad consensus, maybe not in the details of the solution, but in the need for one, and often in some of the specifics. Climate change is an example. In every region of the world, there are strong majorities supporting bold action to confront climate change. Israel-Palestine, an incredibly loaded, complex issue, is another example where in Israel, in Palestine, and around the world, most people support a two-state solution. And what often happens across those issues and many others is that people with either a stake in the status quo or an extremely strong stake in particular aspects of the solution are able to block what is almost an obvious solution that the world is sort of driving towards. And so what Avaaz tries to do is use technology and to help build campaigns and in a sense give global public opinion teeth on these issues. And so what we've been able to do, aggregating from campaign to campaign, is build this community from we sort of soft launched in the fall of 2006. Now it's 2009. We have 3.5 million people with a relatively small, globally distributed team that has an ethic of member service to our membership, which is all across the world. It's a essentially flat age spectrum, so there's as many 20-year-olds as there are 70-year-olds. The median age of our membership is around 50. Geographically, 10% are in the U.S. As a percent of internet users, we're stronger in Southern Africa and Canada and Australia and Europe. Obviously, internet penetration is higher in the richer countries. So we're about 30% of our membership is in the global south. And we have, particular spikes in particular countries. Our largest country, membership-wise, is France, where we have about 400,000 members. But I think it's highest as a percentage of the population overall in Singapore, where we have 25,000 members. There are 14 countries across all the world's regions where we have more than 1% of the adult population. And the mechanism that we use for campaigns is first to essentially ask our members what they're interested in. So we poll regularly and find out issues of general concern. But then on the staff, we see our role as translating those into specific campaigns where there are actions people can take that will have a meaningful effect on those issues. And we'll do a case study later, but that ranges anywhere from petitions to, flooding leaders with messages to raising money for, right now raising money to support proxy services to help Iranian activists access to the internet during the shutdown. That process, we consult members who have expertise or are in the affected areas. We consult other experts. We, work on it ourselves. But then the ultimate check is the membership, because we test all of our campaigns before they go out to the broad list. So we'll send an email to a random sample of 10,000 people, and we'll see both the numerical, but also the qualitative response. And if a campaign is not compelling, or if members have strong objections, we simply don't run it. And what that means is that, as a typical Avaaz member, occasionally you'll receive, tested campaigns that don't go anywhere, but by and large, you're receiving campaigns that, have already sort of been found to connect with where our members are at. And that, for us, is a critical, it's sort of in our DNA, both ideologically we think that's the right way to do it, but also because our little staff and our computers have no intrinsic power on their own. The power of this model, and it's true across many groups, comes entirely from the actions that are taken by people around the world. And if we don't serve our membership well, then it will shrink and it won't respond. And if we do serve it well, then together we can create change on a whole range of issues. There's this idea that the internet is a series of tubes. Global civil society, in a sense, is a series of tubs. So historically, there have been organizations that specialize in issue areas. Here, poverty, Burma, climate, Zimbabwe. And if there's a desire of people around the world want to take action on one of these issues, they can become part of this organization. Each organization builds a membership base, builds perhaps a brand, builds power, essentially, the power to make a difference on things. And eventually, if things go well, the junta's overturned and replaced with a pluralistic, peaceful democracy, and the climate stabilizes safely. But it's very difficult to do. And one thing the internet offers is the possibility of connecting tubes to tubs, so that you can channel the water towards whatever fires are burning at a particular moment. And so Avaaz is intentionally a multi-issue group. We don't segment the list by topic, and we connect. For most people around the world, if you're concerned about Burma and the crackdown that happened there, that probably is rooted in the same values that would lead you to be concerned about the civil war in Sri Lanka. And what we found is actually also about climate change and the whole spectrum of global issues. And it's just a fact of kind of technology and institutional structures that it's been so difficult for people to be involved in this whole range of issues historically. And so another part of the Avaaz and this model is a light touch, where people can be involved in a whole range of things very quickly, and we look for ways that their actions can aggregate into something powerful. We have this idea that our members are presidents and prime ministers, and so when we write an email to our members, we have just a moment of their time, and we can say, here's the thing, this thing that's going on, here's an action we think that, if you do it, it'll have this effect. Let me know if you want to do it. And people, decide very, very quickly when they receive emails or are exposed to any kind of media how to react. So this is sort of our idea about the plumbing, is that people should be able to flow smoothly through, and also wind up in the right spot. So the metaphors we use are this creates a megaphone to draw attention to issues that need a focus. It's a lightning rod. Well, that's actually a Tesla coil, but it looks cooler. That's a lightning rod that can help bring amorphous public concern and channel it into effective targeted action. It's a battery. One of the things that you get with, for example, Facebook, is that often, you know, there's something happens, people get together, they, for example, join a Facebook group, and there's all this energy that comes together, but essentially it acts as a kind of, it's almost like a waterline. You can see how high the interest level reached. But after that, it's very difficult to help kind of store that energy and tell people next time there's something that can be done. And so, rather than building from scratch for each issue, Avaaz and this model generally, in its many incarnations, allows you to take to build a movement, and then to say, you know, last year there was a crackdown, now there's a cyclone in Burma, and be able to build on that. And if you think about, you know, one of our inspirations was the international campaign against landmines, that was a very rapid but nonetheless years long process that achieved this enormous global victory. That had to build from scratch. Now there's an international campaign against cluster munitions that was built on the same organizing model as the landmine campaign. But a difference that we were proud of is that when they got to the point where there was a summit of a bunch of countries, they were agreeing on a treaty to ban cluster munitions, and a few countries tried to poke holes in the treaty. They had stockpiles of weapons, so they wanted the treaty to only affect the future manufacture of weapons, or they wanted exemptions for certain types of cluster munitions. They were able to contact us, and we were able to generate, you know, a flood, like 50,000 messages to the, I believe, Finnish Prime Minister, urging him to stop trying to riddle the treaty with loopholes. And there would have been no way to generate that kind of public outcry focused on Finland about cluster munitions without a kind of a battery, essentially a reservoir of this interconnected people who share a broad set of values and concerns, but are able to zap in a targeted way when it counts. If you'll forgive the militaristic or law enforcementistic metaphor, we also are like a SWAT team on segways.
In the sense of being able to operate in a very targeted way. And part of this, again, is by institutional design. Groups that we work with and are huge fans of often have enormous staff that have offices in many different countries. And that has certain tremendous advantages, but it also means that they can't take certain types of political actions. And Zimbabwe is a good example of that, where a lot of our partners aren't able to, for example, say that Mugabe was not democratically elected or re-elected because their in-country staff aren't safe. Now, Avaaz has many members in Zimbabwe, but by our model, we're able to be explicitly political, which usually doesn't mean being partisan, but we're able to, you know, do things that with other structures might put a lot of people at risk. And finally, at our best, we're a stem cell that can grow into whatever type of entity or thing or support whatever type of thing is needed at a particular moment. So what does this mean in practice? A quick example is Burma in 2007. There was this massive people-powered moment, this uprising of the Burmese monks and the democracy movement. We were flooded with messages from our members saying, you know, what can we do? Can we do something? We polled quickly. There was a tremendous level of interest. There was a Facebook group growing. We launched a petition. Our petition reached at that time, 760,000, shortly after, I think it peaked at about 800,000 people. And 600,000 of the 850 were new to Avaaz. This is, you know, one example of how net-centric and broadcast organizing aren't different, is that essentially both are successful on a friend-to-friend, personal, social networks basis. So this was spread entirely by word of mouth, like all of Avaaz campaigns. We built this petition and presented it it was a message to the UN Security Council and especially China to urge the Burmese junta to stop the crackdown, presented the petition. But really, I think the petition was the existence of a large Facebook group. That was just the beginning of the meaningful actions that were taken. And so from there, we were able to contact our membership in Europe and have them flood their members of European Parliament to support stronger sanctions on the targeted to the Burmese regime. Our members in Singapore pressured their foreign minister to draw a stronger line with the junta's generals who would come for medical care and vacation. Then we raised about $300,000 the next week to channel communications equipment through the Thai border to democracy movement activists who were endangered by both, first the government shut down access to the internet, but then it was tracking everyone who used a cell phone. So it was to get satellite communications technology and things that would allow people to evade the government and continue their movement. And it was an exciting moment in our history because we were able to, you know, immediately work with groups that had been established in this area for a long time and get guidance about what would make a meaningful difference, to work closely with the democracy movement, but then to help bring in a huge number of people that otherwise wouldn't have known what they could do to help make a difference. Fast forward to the next spring, Cyclone Nargis hit Burma, and there was the government wasn't issuing visas to humanitarian aid workers. And so there was this dire catastrophe. The only people really providing emergency relief services were the monks themselves, and people were taking refuge in monasteries. We were contacted by the International Burmese Monks Association, which we'd connected with the previous fall, and they recorded a video appeal to our members, and we raised $2 million that were channeled through their networks to monasteries to provide relief within the country without, without anyone needing visas and kind of under the radar of the government. And we played obviously a very small part in what they did, but they're essentially credited with saving tens of thousands of lives and avoiding the worst kinds of epidemic and famine that were threatened at the time. That's sort of one instance. There's a lot else we've done in Burma and a whole range of other issues. Our sort of most visible public manifestation is probably in the form of newspaper advertisements. This one was run in the Jakarta Post on the last day of the Bali Climate Summit. We built this rapid petition. We were running ads in Canada and doing everything we could to pressure these three leaders, and particularly the guys on the sides. Bush has never been very receptive to public outcry. But the goal was to get these countries to allow midterm targets on climate change, and they both, in the last day of the summit, caved and allowed a reference to 2020 targets, and later we learned from the Asahi Shimbun, which is on the right, that at the Japanese cabinet meeting where this was being discussed, the environment minister waved the ad and said, "Is this how we want the world to see us, as a force blocking progress on climate change?" And they adopted, or they agreed to set a 2020 target. Now again, I'm happy with the ad, but I think the force of this was that it came in the exact right moment, and that it carried the force of massive numbers of people around the world contributing their voices to it, and then also even funding it. In Japan, one aspect of these campaigns that's been reported on the most is that these are small donations from large numbers of people, which is not a customary part of especially of sort of Japanese NGO to public relationship. This is a similar kind of thing we ran last year, focused on Germany, which was about to pull back from it, or was threatening to really mess up Europe's climate and energy policy. This kind of work can range from public protests to, we've had planes fly over the United Nations with messages to Thabo Mbeki, public opinion polls, stunts, television ads. We've also organized solidarity fasts to support a hunger strike focused on Zimbabwe. There's a whole range of different things you can do. And the question is, how to do more? So they say that all you have is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And we try to be conscious of the fact that we have an Allen wrench that is useful to apply certain kinds of torque, but there's lots of issues and lots of public decision-making processes that aren't amenable to the type of public pressure that we can help bring. The question is, you know, one of the weaknesses, I think, or one of the challenges for the UVAS model is that because everything is mediated through the staff, there's a limit on the throughput. There's a limit on the amount of campaigns that we can run, and there are, we're constantly, you know, being asked to do things about issues that we simply don't have the team capacity to do. And there's also, you know, a vast amount of expertise out there that we have difficulty tapping. So recently, a lot of our most successful campaigning efforts have been at the national level. Last week, President Lula in Brazil agreed to veto two really bad provisions that would have threatened the future of the Amazon. And that was a campaign we heard about through Brazilian NGOs, ran only to a Brazilian membership, and we were able to generate tens of thousands of phone calls and emails to Lula in a very short period of time. And according to our contacts there, it really made the difference or helped make the difference in the president's decision. But there are, at any given moment, there are decisions of tremendous import that are happening all over the place. And it seems like there's got to be a way to sort of open things up so that our members in whatever country can say, this is happening, this is a crisis, we'd like to do something about it, but yet keep that filter and keep the commitment to the idea of only running things if they actually do connect with the membership in the relevant area. And that means both having emails that essentially have the structure and the quality of highly condensed and direct, simple briefings, which is not a, you know, good emails are not a natural form of writing for most people that are focused on the action people can take as opposed to giving information about the topic. Both the quality and also making sure that people only, you know, are only getting good campaigns. There's something that happens very often in kind of open email lists, for example, is that a lot of people get involved, and then the people with the most time or the most strong opinions drown out the other people. And it winds up declining in value very rapidly for people who only have a little bit of time to be involved. And what we're about is finding ways for large numbers of people to be meaningfully involved without being drowned out or you know, without getting 30 emails a day, for example, and it not being worth it. So we have a couple of ideas on this front. One of them is we've started creating kind of high activity local sublists. There's one going right now in Copenhagen, for example, where the big climate summit is this December that should set the global UN treaty. And members there are organizing, coming up with activities. They're at a big music festival this weekend with cutouts of the G8 leaders in green hard hats and asking people to take their picture with the leaders with green hard hats on, representing green jobs from Action on Climate Change, and build this photo petition for the G8. So they had this idea. We worked with them to develop it, and then now we can contact all of our, I think, 23,000 members in Denmark. That takes a lot of staff involvement, and you know, one of the principles of having a relatively small staff is that as organizations grow, they tend to each person spends more of their time thinking about relationships with other members of staff and internally focused, and less time thinking about serving membership and about impact on the world. And we're keenly conscious of wanting to keep the external focus so that we don't become driven by organizational inertia as opposed to the mandate from our membership to help them create change. Another idea is to basically have a kind of an Avaz Academy where we have public training systems to teach people how to do this kind of online activism, and then they have them submit campaigns in a structured way, collaboratively filter and rate campaign proposals, and then when good stuff emerges, to poll and test it and then potentially run it. And to try to do that, you know, at the national level or on specific issues. Those are two models that we're thinking about. And we also do a lot of, you know, spreading the ideas in the model and trying to support other groups doing when we have something to offer, trying to share how it's done. But we're looking for ways that we can improve on that. It feels, you know, what we keep feeling is that this model and this sort of new world of public engagement on a at a mass scale, very rapidly on a wide range of issues, it's just in its infancy. And there are examples all over the world of sort of people power channeled through technology making a huge difference in both in decisions and ultimately in people's lives as they're affected by those decisions. And I think that there's a global gap still in the models that we have that can help unleash public concern around these issues to help close the gap between the world we have and the world most people want. So I'd love to hear your suggestions. This is what I've just said. And ultimately, we're all in one big tub. So I hope we can splash around together a little. Thank you. Any questions or? Yes.
Have you ever encountered a situation where people wanted to use your tools for a purpose that you really, you or your staff or the founders of this really did not agree with?
Yeah. There's a few different types of examples. One is when there's a kind of a tactic that a group of people are really excited about and we're not so sure about. And an example of that is around the Olympics. There were a lot of different groups that were calling for an Olympic boycott. And we got a lot of messages from people around the world saying, you know, support a boycott of the Olympics. Let's, you know, try to get athletes to say they're not going to go. And, you know, within the staff, our analysis was that actually that would likely backfire within China in terms of opening things up with respect to Tibet and with Burma, that the sensitivity was very high. And my wife, Beth, and I had dinner with a bunch of members in Hong Kong, and they, as one, said, this will result in the fist tightening as opposed to opening. So we thought about it, and we came up with some other ideas, the best of which was a campaign based on a handshake as the symbol that was about dialogue. And we polled a bunch of our members, both in that region and around the world, about the sort of different ideas that had been proposed. And we found that our membership was, and we, obviously, us writing the polls, there's a risk of leaning things one way or the other. But we tried to write a very neutral poll and found that our membership actually, as we find often, it's very deliberative, and our members respond most to appeals, even in emotional contexts, that have a logical argument and an idea that's grounded in values, but actually explains not just why an action would have expressive value, but actually why it would help achieve a result in the world. And so ultimately, our broad membership has been the most effective check on that. What we haven't experienced yet is a case where, you know, a huge mass of our membership wants to do something that's just totally doesn't align with the staff. Ultimately, you know, you'd have to hack into the email system to send an email, you know, calling for nuclear war or whatever, because someone like me has to type it in and hit the send button. But broadly, in a sense, I think that I've heard that this is a myth, but ostriches supposedly or flamingos are pink because they eat shrimp and they turn pink, so you are what you eat. And Abbas campaigns are built on the kind of globalist values, the idea that every human life is equally precious. And so members are people who've been attracted by those campaigns. And so there's a kind of a rolling sense in which Abbas becomes the group of people that share a set of values, which are the things Abbas does. Yeah.
Thanks so much for giving this talk and sharing what's up. I'm curious a little bit more about how Abbas is governed. And in particular, I remember Fred Wertheimer from Common Cause came once to talk about his organization, which is about cleaning up government and making it accountable and everything. and in true Medium Bean message, you are what you eat, he had made Common Cause a membership organization as a term of art to lawyers. The members of the organization actually could vote and depose the board or appoint a new president or something. And then one day, crazy members showed up to the anemic annual meeting and tried to do just that. And his lesson was to eliminate the membership and make it something run by a tyrant who's benevolent called Fred Wertheimer. And the board is succession by right of kings. So I'm wondering along that spectrum where Avaaz falls and whether you see those kinds of governance issues as kind of a distraction. It's like the staff and the founder set the tone and then people either gather around it or not, or whether you somehow aspire to have the organization itself become organically governed, maybe the way Wikipedia sometimes is.
It's a really good question. I guess the kernel of an answer is that there's a few part answers. So part one is we see ourselves very much as like one group of people in a really huge, noisy room full of people. And so to some extent, Avaaz is part of this sort of rich fabric of the world. And unlike a government, it's completely voluntary. And so part of the way that we operate is that rather than campaign speaking on behalf of all 3.5 million members, campaign communications and speaking is always just on behalf of the members who participated in a particular campaign. The structure, there's a small board, there's a small staff, and there's the membership, and we have, in a sense, a hierarchical structure and a horizontal culture. So that, ultimately, our executive director greenlights campaigns that go out the door. But, by policy, he only greenlights campaigns that have the endorsement of a random sampling of the members. And also in practice, if we stray from that, there've been emails here, well, there've lots of emails that we test that don't get that response. If we go off from that direction, then we essentially collapse because our funding, for example, is membership driven. We have some support from a handful of foundations. I think we're 80% plus membership funded now. Our membership is membership driven. And the thing that we, the thing that we don't want to do is essentially we don't want the organization to be directed either by the whims of its staff or by the whims of a small group of members that's unrepresentative of the whole. And so that's essentially our core system for accountability. But in the sense of having direct elections for staff and board and things, I think I don't think we don't do it right now, but also I don't think it actually is the way that we can serve the kind of mission and membership the best, because in a sense that every campaign is something people can opt in or out of. But if you're requiring people to get deeply involved in the kind of organizational dynamics by itself, then you're rewarding the people that are most focused on that.
Yeah.
Like, that's the group that you're empowering.
I think Fred Wertheimer would happily agree with you. It also just makes me think that the kind of way you vet ideas is kind of quasi-Darwinistic. You kind of put them out there. They mutate out of nowhere. And then you do the sampling, and it either gathers Mo or it doesn't. And it would be interesting just to think about Lamarckian ways of doing it too, which might mean for a given issue that the members are seized with, there might be multiple approaches to dealing with it, some of which aren't exclusive of each other, and people then can check a box or more than one box as to how they want to be involved, a petition here, a donation there. Or if there are alternative approaches, to be able to label them as such and have some process where the membership actually deliberates in some way, and then you can see which approach gets momentum and which doesn't. That might run afoul of your worry that only the people with time to do it would do it, and that could be a bad self-selected group. But
we actually do a fair amount of that.
Yeah.
It varies from moment to moment. So some things like Lula's potential veto just now in Brazil, there was a 3-day window, and we took our best shot at something that would be, you know, make a difference and ran with it. The global economic collapse is an example of a complex issue where it's not clear where the public stands. And we did a prolonged deliberative poll where we that ultimately went to, I think the full membership was invited to participate, first generating options for different types of economic structures and then looking at arguments for and against each, people weighing in with them and voting their support. And we wound up with a package of things, which I don't think the staff particularly could have predicted in advance, but those are the messages that we were able to ultimately bring to the G20 summit, head of the IMF, to public marches and all kinds of stuff. That emerged out of that process. And, you know, sometimes it's a global deliberation like that. Very often, when we're working in a particular region or area, the ideas will come from the people who are affected by it. And so in Congo, for example, we contacted our members there, asked what should be done, got a lot of responses, got people to respond to each other's responses. And to our surprise, the thing that really emerged with tremendous backing was to have a European peacekeeping force, basically just standing there and making sure people weren't killing each other. And that's, you might sort of expect and then we polled our members in Europe and they were strongly supportive of it as well. And we ran a campaign urging that. So we do try to build that in. Sometimes the best thing we can do is to do something really quickly. But we've always been really surprised and impressed by the thoughtfulness and the expertise of members when there's a sort of channel for input that's set up in a deliberative way.
Listening to you, when you say action, what I hear is writing letters to politicians and bureaucrats and sending money. That's a very narrow view of action. And let me give you an example. In Cambridge, once a month, we do a weatherization barn raise, and we just did one on Sunday. And the organization that does that home energy efficiency team, the flyer that they put out is, Congress is not doing anything to reduce carbon, let's do it ourselves. So it's practical action on the ground, and it would be very interesting to make that model viral. I'm particularly interested in the example of the White House organic garden and thinking about doing a weatherization barn raising on the White House with participation of this old house, extreme home makeover, home and garden channel, those kinds of things. But to link the online, all right, letter writing, donation campaign with practical things that people can do within their own lives, which changes conditions on the ground. And I think that is a model that I haven't seen. A second thing that I haven't seen is best practices to do these practical things, right? And have some place where people can come together and do best practices so that they can learn from what's happening in this town or in this country and adapt it to their own use. It seems to me we give away our power all the time when we think that writing a letter or talking to your Congress critter is the most that you can do. And that's generally what these things are. You know, that's the idea. I talk to my congresspeople. I write letters, but I live my life in a particular way, which I think accords with my principles, and I think a lot of these people do also. And they have methods by which they do that, which could empower other people on their individual lives. And I'm wondering if Avaaz can make that leap from action as writing letters, sending money, to action as direct action, having real products within your daily life that empower individuals and communities?
That's a great question, too. At one level, you know, what happens on the internet often stays on the internet, and using online activity as a way to unleash offline activity is a core direction that we're going and something we're working on in a lot of respects. But on the question of individual behavior change, if you imagine that a group like Avaaz is a TV show where there's a group of producers and hosts that can urge an audience to do something, I think that makes more sense for encouraging people to change a practice that there is in front of them, versus thinking of Avaaz as the group of people, you know, in a sense, Avaaz doesn't exist to lobby its members to do something, because the strength of Avaaz is its members. And so looking for ways to share best practices or things like that, I think, is something that we are well positioned to do. But, you know, we don't kind of market to ourselves in a sense. And we, I think the service that the emails provide is, actions that, when aggregated quickly, can have a significant impact. And there are types of consumer practices that can do that. But if you look at the gigatons of carbon that are being admitted to the atmosphere, and where that carbon comes from, a huge amount of it is stuff that's outside the purview of individual decisions in our own lives. And one example is the packaging of the products we use, or the source of the electricity that we use to power things. You can use less electricity, but even if, you know, all 3.5 million members reduce their personal consumption by 50%, which is very difficult to do given institutional structures, and it's also not something that emails typically are good vehicles for coordinating. Even if that happened, I don't think that would move the needle that far towards achieving the kind of global shift in fundamental structures that we need. And so where personal personal action and sacrifice can have a powerful political effect, boycotts, very public boycotts are one example of that, or targeted corporate campaigns where people stop buying or buy a specific product or display an action, those things can shift sort of larger structures, but Avaaz, in its DNA, is not about it's about helping people find ways to take actions on things where they know that their own where taking an action alone is not going to have this difference, but by pushing together they can topple a huge domino, which then can continue the domino effect into a complex world. I hear your concern, but I guess that's my answer. Yeah.
Let me just codify what I think Jay-Z was asking, this person was asking. I'm listening to you, and I really appreciate your presentation, and I read about Avaaz online. What metrics what day will Avaaz close its door and the gap be closed between the world that you want and the world that you think you can have? And what metrics are you using to be accountable to the communities that you engage in terms of showing some demonstrative effect beyond certainly the impressive amount of money that you've raised and the number of people who are now online? But what other metrics are you employing that would say, this is how much closer we are to the world we want?
So, first, in terms of the world most people everywhere want, there's actually pretty good global public polling on a large range of issues, and that's the basic touchstone. And that's both on, you know, questions like, do people want stronger protections for the environment, but also on values, you know, across religions and cultures and countries. There's a lot of alignment on, you know, basic rights and people's rights to live with dignity. Yeah.
Within a Abbasist structure, like, where is that explicit to the person who would want to sign up?
It's so, you know, VAS in a sense exists in moments and in specific campaigns. And so signing a petition or organizing one an event and a global day of action, you're getting involved in that campaign, and then you'll receive future emails. But each action and each campaign is rooted usually explicitly in those basic values. And so, you know, when Avaz kind of as a community or an organization interfaces with the world, it doesn't claim to, Avaz doesn't kind of take positions on issues. There's not a manifesto, but rather the Avaz brand, if you will, is sort of deployed on behalf of the people and the specific number of people in the countries where they took the action. To sort of showcase or to help give the word of Oz means voice in a bunch of languages, to help give voice to the people who participated in that. You know, I don't think about the ultimate metric of success for what we do, and I would hope for what other NGOs that work in this kind of area or individuals working to affect the world, the ultimate metric is change in actual conditions of life on this planet, maybe elsewhere eventually. So, you know, a campaign isn't a success if it raises a lot of money, but then the money doesn't reach people who can use it to do things that make a difference. Or if it's a phone-in campaign, we might generate a lot of calls that were misdirected, and in the world as complex as it is, there are no really good yardsticks for measuring what your marginal effect is on these systems. But the best you can do is try to figure it out and try to hold yourself to that standard and to tell members where you can what happened and how things turned out, and there's a kind of, I guess, accountability and practice of that if we something a lot of especially political groups do is create petitions to nowhere, where they're essentially list building exercises, and they're trying to grow their email lists, and that is a recipe ultimately for not having any, not building trust and not building the ability to kind of be invested with the power of people's aggregated action. So. I think if we do our job badly, it circles back and it's less effective the next time. Yeah.
Is there a place on your website where one could easily find the action steps that you've organized, what it generated, and then what the ultimate impact was? I was looking on the website yesterday, and one I was looking at, and I don't remember which one. The action was to get a lot of signatures on a petition that I think was then delivered to the British Prime Minister and Secretary General of the UN. But then I didn't sort of see the follow-up of what the impact of delivering those petitions was. And I couldn't even really see the connection of why it was to those two people. And I wish I could remember what the action was.
So it's a really good question. And the answer is slightly embarrassing, which is that overwhelmingly, the way that people interact with the VAS is through email. And so, like, 98%+ of traffic on our website, for example, is from direct links from emails. And so we actually spend very little time making the website any good. We tend to spend a lot of time writing emails, writing follow-up emails. Often we forget to post them to the website anywhere. And it means that people who are involved in those campaigns, you know, if we're doing a good job, get a, you know, rich follow-up explanation, all that stuff, but it's almost impossible to find it on the site. So that's something that we're working on actively right now, is to make sure that things are automatically posted and indexed and searchable and all that stuff. But often the best way, if you're curious about a particular campaign, the best thing to do is Google and look at other sites where people have reposted the email about it. And you'll, you know, find the photos of the delivery and what the message was and what we thought happened next and should happen. But that's a dead on. Yeah. I mean, I'm sure we could do a better job also of following up, because sometimes there's a, you know, if you're trying to decide between doing something about the Sri Lanka Civil War or sending a report back about what happened about, you know, swine flu from the previous week, it's a difficult trade-off. And that's, but when we're good, yes, the results are communicated, and the best way to get them is by email. Question there and then there. Yeah.
Yeah, I was going to ask earlier, but I think you've answered the question. How does your mode of operation produce long-term changes on a single topic? But I'm coming to the conclusion, based upon what you answered previous questions, it's almost like you're taking a second action of what Muhammad Ali called float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. And so,
yeah.
So it seems like you're really focusing on short-term actions that can make some change for a particular issue, rather than mobilizing a group of people for a long-term campaign.
I think that's right in a sense, but what we, I mean, there's two things. One is that, you know, the individual campaigns are within, they're couched in a sort of strategic analysis that's grounded in the sort of, you know, long-term goals or values that our members have. And so, you know, supporting democracy in Zimbabwe is one example. Each individual element, you know, this week it's a, you know, support for a march to the South Africa Development Community Summit in Johannesburg. The next it's focused on the UN. Each one is, in a sense, disconnected. But what happens over time is that the number of people that are involved in different parts of that campaign grows. Now it's about 400,000 people around the world. That's actually a little, it might be well over that now, have been part of Zimbabwe campaigning. And, you know, Zimbabwe, unlike Tibet or Burma, there is no kind of global network of groups that work on Zimbabwe issues and lobby their governments. But now there are 400,000 people across the world, especially in Southern Africa, but across the world that are engaged and can be, you know, sort of remobilized around moments. And that's, I think, it's sort of a snowball, like picking up these little different elements. That's the way it builds toward longer term change. Yeah.
I understand you don't really update the website that much, but most of the like action team you've built around grabbing global public opinion, grabbing the attention span of certain people. But then you have this one for Iran, which is based on funding secure bandwidth and proxy servers for the Iranians to communicate. So the question is, what percentage of your actions are based around public opinion, getting the attention of certain people, versus everything else?
Boy, I think it's probably about half and half, or maybe like 40% global public opinion. One of the reasons why that's not as immediately transparent is that a lot of the campaigns that use other channels for influence happen at a sub-global level. And so they'll just be everyone in Europe, or they'll be, you know, governments are accountable to their citizens in different ways, or in Zimbabwe, for example, right around the time of the election, we were working with a bunch of Zimbabwean groups, so that when there was a you know, government raid on an NGO office and people were beaten and then imprisoned, we would alert like a group of 10,000 people, and they would flood embassies and government offices with messages about those specific people. And the theory was that, you know, just if there's a sense that there are calls coming in from embassies saying, hey, what's going on with this person, that, you know, makes them at least would make them hesitate before willy-nilly beating people up. But those sort of campaign actions were less visible on a global level. We do a lot of, like in recent weeks, you know, we'll do advertising campaigns where that makes sense. We'll fund public opinion polls for release. We'll do, with Tibet, with Iran now, we're doing support for internet access. A whole range of things like that. But I think over time, we're sort of moving more and more towards those types of things that leverage activity beyond just the outcry.
I mean, just to interject, right? Like when I go to your site for the first time and all I see are like, sign this petition, it's very easy for me to get petition overload just because everyone sends petitions. If you were looking for ways to get more people involved, maybe emphasizing the other things, right? Like if it seems like a novel, creative way to make change, like for example, during the entire Iranian, the protests and whatnot, there was this great sense of frustration. There was like, turn your webpage green, and that was about the most anyone could do, right? But there wasn't this much what if I wanted to donate money to help the Iranians? And then here, you actually have a way to do it, and that's something I feel like that's not getting as much, attention out there.
Yeah. I think that's right. I mean, part of the thing is that in every online organizing kind of initiative, the highest participation rate by far is, with one exception, which I'll mention in a second, is petitions. So, for example, with a fundraising campaign, it'll be like 1/100th of the number of people that would sign a petition will donate, even if the express support for that activity is just as high. And when we track how many people tell how many friends about campaigns, and it's just, it's highest typically with petitions where there's both strong, intense emotions and also a theory for how the petition will be delivered that'll be meaningful. We had a moment recently in Canada where they were slashing public broadcasting funding. In Canada and lots of other places, one of the only places to get lots of international news. And we did a petition that celebrities in Canada wore buttons about the petition at their national kind of Oscars ceremony, and the opposition delivered it in a public session to the Harper government. So that petition had a lot of channels to get through, and it exploded there. But all the other types of things that you can mobilize to the internet, actually, typically people are less familiar with it. They're less comfortable sending it to other people, and even if it's much cooler, it tends to only be seen by the people who are initially emailed. The one exception is MoveOn.org did this video. I don't know if people saw it, where you could put in, like before the election, you could put in a friend's name, and then it would generate a video about how that friend not voting cost Obama the election. And that was forwarded around and I think seen 25 million times, and there was a tick box to join the MoveOn list if you went through that, and it was an enormous source of growth. So that was one of the, and we're looking, I think novel things like that are great, but there needs to be a kind of embedded social logic for why people should tell other people about it, for things to kind of spread the word that way.
I have just a question. I was noticing when I went to the front page that you've got all these different languages, and I heard what you said about them. But I'm curious why the ones that you chose, and why not Farsi? Why not other certain?
We've actually just launched in Farsi, but we haven't added it to the header of the site. one thing is that doing sort of political organizing in different languages is more than translation. It's actually kind of rewriting in the political idiom of that language group. And so it's a fairly, intensive process. And right now we do it either with staff or with highly engaged volunteers and sometimes paid translators helping. One of the sort of sets of tools that we're hoping to build, and if people have advice about where these can be found if they exist already, is to have tools where people can get involved in translating into their language. And we have many, many more requests to, you know, expand into different language groups than we're currently able to handle. So, you know, I would love for us to be able to do everything in hundreds of languages, but we have to figure out how to do that without becoming basically a translation organization. Yeah.
Just wondering how often your members will reject an idea you suggested, and if there's ever been cases where something gets approved by the polled members, but the general membership really thought it was a bad idea?
That's a good question. I can't think of a time when something has gotten strong support in a test and then hasn't had the strong support in the general membership. I would say maybe 30% of our somewhere between 30 and 50% of things that we test don't sort of pass the threshold. There are a larger number of things that we, you know, put out there and think around or pull around and shut down earlier than that. As we've, you know, as members of staff have been involved in this longer, we're kind of, first of all, we're in more touch with more members more often, but also I think we have a better sense of what's going to connect. But there are some things like Cuba, for example. A while around the time Fidel Castro left office, we ran a poll about Cuba and found enormous support for a campaign just urging the U.S. embargo to end. So we put together it wasn't a particularly inspired campaign, but it was a, you know, petition and a channel for delivering it. And then we sent a test email, and the response was really, really weak. And basically, it was because even though people cared about that issue, it just wasn't top of the mind, and there wasn't a convincing reason to think that something could actually change. Fast forward to just now, the Summit of the Americas, where Obama went to Trinidad and met with all the South American leaders and Latin American leaders. In that instance, we tested, we changed it up, and we figured out a way to. Actually, a bunch of Avaaz members in Trinidad were involved in sail. And there was the president of the Trinidadian Sailing Association is an Avaaz member, and helped us get boats with sails that said "Lift the embargo on Cuba." That we sailed out into the waters where the summit was, and that there was a really strong response to, and so you know it went forward.
I never heard anybody doing that before.
Yeah, and you know it's. The people's response to things so much is based on whether there's a good idea there. If you ask people to turn out for a rally, you'll get many fewer people than if you ask them to come and join an aerial photo where, you know, they'll all spell out a message to the world with their bodies. And, you know, that's a illustrative of just a whole range of things a friend says, what you need to know about online organizing is that it's exactly the same as offline organizing. And if something's not interesting to you offline, there's no reason to think that putting it on a website would make it interesting. That, like, you know, a viral video is just a video that's really great and people want to send it around, and it would have been passed around on video cassette if it happened 20 years before. And sort of, you know, subjecting things to that test of whether you actually think it's engaging and worthwhile is... has served us pretty well. Any other questions from folks? So I'd like to ask you guys a question, which is, it's basically this question of if there's an issue that you feel strongly about, and that Avaaz could do something about it. What would be the most convenient way to tell Avaaz that you want to do something about it? Like, the question is how to create sort of